You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the Christmas bird count and about everything you wanted to know about birds and seeing them and listening to them and how to watch them and what's happening in the bird count this year. And my next guest has traveled down to Chiapas, Mexico to study some coffee plantations that use the shade-grown technique on a shade-grown coffee farm. And the shrubs line the forest floor, the coffee shrubs, and they grow in the shade of these larger trees overhead. And the forest, this is really interesting because the forest is not only good for the coffee plants, but it also attracts migratory birds, which they're no dummies. They'd rather spend the winter there or make pit stops on their journey rather than bake in the sun-drenched, low-level conventional coffee farms. And the shade also offers them more places to forage and to hide. And along with the birds, you got your bats and your bees. They flock to the shade grown plantation for the same reason. And new research suggests, and here's what's most interesting about it, that what's good for the birds, bats, and bees just might be good for the biodiversity of the forest trees, too. Joining me now to talk about why is my guest. Sharlani Jaw is a PhD student in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and she joins us by phone today. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi there, Ira.
Hi, how are you? Well, tell us, why is this good for the biodiversity of the forest trees, too?
Well, as you described, shade coffee farms provide a lot of habitat for native birds and bats, and these are critical players in dispersing the seeds of native trees. So what we found in our study was that if you look at the genetic signature of some of these native trees, we looked at a tree called the Meconia. It's in the genus Meconia, which is one of the most common understory trees in the neotropics. But if you look at the genetic signature of this tree in the coffee farms as well as in the forest, you can tell that in the coffee farms particularly, the seeds are getting dispersed extensively. And we're attributing this to the abundant seed dispersers that we find in the coffee farms, which are migratory birds, resident birds, and bats.
Mm-hmm. Is shade-grown coffee a new thing?
No, so shade-grown coffee actually was the traditional style of growing coffee, and only recently in the last 30 or 40 years have we seen this conversion in some places to sun coffee. So because coffee is an understory plant, it was conventionally thought that it would always be best to grow in the shade because that brings forth the best flavor in the coffee, and you can plant nitrogen-fixing overstory trees, so trees that provide nitrogen for the coffee plants to use. Mm-hmm. So it was always grown in the understory, and only recently, with the advent of some hybrid or new breeds of coffee, people have started to grow it in the sun. What we find then is that you don't have a lot of the ecological services which benefit the coffee in shade systems, like the pollinators, the birds that handle the pests for the coffee, and the parasitoids, which also control coffee pests, as well as just providing habitat for biodiversity.
How many kinds of birds can you find down there with the coffee plants?
Well, thanks to our colleagues at the Smithsonian Migratory Bird Center, they've done a lot of coffee mist netting and point counts of birds, and they found about 180 species, I believe, in shade coffee. So it's extensive. I mean, there's a lot of bird diversity in these coffee farms.
Do they eat the coffee beans?
They actually don't eat the coffee beans that often. There's usually, in these shade coffee systems, especially coffee that's certified as bird-friendly, mm-hmm. there has to be a lot of over-story and sort of medium-sized tree diversity in these farms. And so it provides the birds with a lot of foraging options, a lot of berries and nuts and things. Mm-hmm. So that's actually the reason why we chose to study this Meconia tree, because mm-hmm. The birds forage on it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Sharlani, thank you for taking time to be with us. Quite interesting.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Sharlani Jaw is a PhD student in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Michigan. We're going to continue talking about birds, lots of birds this hour. And last time we were in Brooklyn speaking with or listening to Michelle Drager, a volunteer naturalist, do the Christmas bird count over there in Brooklyn in Prospect Park. And when we last left Michelle, she was taking her group through the tour, and describing what to see. Let's see where she is now.
What is it? Another robin?
It looks like.
Uh-huh. Juncos. There's a red-winged blackbird on the floor.
These are good binoculars.
Yes.
Oh, is that a red blackbird?
Yeah, there's a red-winged blackbird in there somewhere.
Yeah, in the tree over there.
Hey, there's Lee. Is he over there?
Yeah. There's a tufted titmouse. Oh, it just flew away. There's a chickadee and a goldfinch on the feeder, along with a downy woodpecker. Really? Here it goes. Here he comes down. He's coming down. Something big in the top of that tree. Let me look who it is. We got a kestrel!
Wait on top?
Up on top. We're looking for what's not on our list. Creeper, chipping sparrow, thrush. Keep an eye out for those three.
Wow, sounds exciting. I love the crunching of the snow. You can see what kind of weather we've had in the New York City area. Also with me is Jeff LeBaron and John Fitzpatrick talking about the Audubon Christmas Count. Interesting out there in Brooklyn. Looks like they were having a lot of fun.
You know, one of the things I love hearing about that, we're just hearing a really young person out there with her. This is one of the best ways to start kids becoming interested in nature is take them out for a few hours of a Christmas bird count. It got me going at age six.
That's absolutely fantastic. Birds just really spark people's interest in, you know, kids of all ages, really, but it's absolutely wonderful to get more and more kids involved with any birding or conservation activities, really.
Mm-hmm. We have a question from Bjornli Loon from Second Life and wanting to know, has global warming demonstrated any change in bird occurrence patterns?
Well, with the Christmas count, actually, what we can do, Audubon is in the midst of starting to analyze what species have shifted over time over the last 50 to 100 years. And what this will do is it'll give us a lot of background and hopefully be able to sort of then make predictions about what might happen as human-induced global climate change scenarios play out. So the CBC is just a wonderful tool for looking into all sorts of things with bird distribution and also trend data. Audubon's published a couple of things over the last few years, the state of the birds, the watch list, and common birds in decline, all of which looked at both the Christmas bird count data and with breeding bird survey data. Mm. So it's wonderful. People get out, they actually get a connection with nature, they get to actually make a contribution that comes back and then actually helps the birds themselves.
John Fitzpatrick?
There is some evidence now beginning to accumulate from a bunch of studies, both in the New World and the Old World, that wintering distributions of birds are drifting northward through time. Exactly whether that's a consequence of global warming alone or a combination of that plus changes in human land use, that takes pretty detailed statistical analyses to ferret out. But there's no question that spring is coming earlier. Many birds are actually breeding quite a few days earlier than they used to. There are a few birds in the far northern Arctic that are undergoing some serious population declines now that are suspected to be a consequence of global warming.
Mm-hmm.
So we're beginning to see some signal.
What is the status of that elusive ivory-billed woodpecker we heard so much about?
I wondered whether you'd ask about that.
You didn't think I would forget.
The ivory-billed, which was spotted in 2004 and 2005 in eastern Arkansas, that individual has eluded us since that point. We have a very large and coordinated search across the entire southeast in not just Arkansas, but Louisiana, Florida, Mississippi, South Carolina. Short version of the story is we've been looking from the very beginning for a breeding pair of birds, and we have not yet found one.
Would it be fair to tag it as allegedly seen or purposedly seen, but not really? Maybe seen?
No question that people differ in their comfort with the evidence. I'm personally comfortable that there was an individual bird there, but others are still skeptical. Irrespective of that, we do know that we need to have a mommy and a daddy to get some recovery going, and that's what we've been looking for from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, we a couple of years ago, in sort of to assist with the study, we actually started up a new count in Arkansas that actually is covering the area where we do hope that we will find them. And we hope what we do is we're hoping that we'll get new ivory bill data in the database, because we actually do have some historical database from ivory bill data from the 30s.
John, you also have a recording of extinct birds, like the Kauai OO, right?
That's right. The Cornell Lab of Ornithology has the world's largest collection of natural sound recordings, including 3/4 of the world's bird species, and I'm happy or sorry to say, depending on your attitude, does include a number of recordings of birds that are known to be extinct or suspected. Kauai o'o is one of the most haunting of all of those sounds.
We actually have some sounds of it, so let's take a listen. Wow, that is one of the most unusual sounds.
Very unusual, sort of jazz-like, slightly haunting sound. That bird, the important thing to know about, that's a male, and this bird used to duet, so that bird is singing part of the song, and the other half would have been filled in by the female. That was actually the last Kauai o'o, a male individual that lived several years in the Alakai Swamp. The bird was attracted down to the recordist by a playback of this sound, and here's this bird who thought he might be hearing a female, and you're actually hearing the very last individual OO ever to exist, went extinct in 1988.
Wow.
Really makes you, once you hear it with that in mind, it gives you a new sense of depth and meaning when you hear bird sounds.
Yeah, to hear something that no longer exists.
Yeah.
Wow. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Dennis in Three Rivers, Michigan. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. How are we doing today?
Hi. How are you?
Good. I appreciate you taking the call. I spotted a bird here about 2 weeks ago that I've been totally unable to identify. It was sitting in a mowed cornfield, pecking at the corn. It was 100% jet black. When it stood up, it had the side silhouette of a pheasant, but it was about half or two-thirds the size of a full-grown ringneck. When it ran a short distance, it had the same gait as a pheasant also, and I haven't been able to find it in any book.
And it was basically either dark chocolate brown or jet black all over?
Correct.
Did it have a long tail like a pheasant?
Yes, it did.
I mean,
maybe
my first guess was
a pheasant tail, but very, very similar.
Yeah, I would wonder if it might be a melanistic or dark, unusually darkly colored pheasant.
Yeah. I have two guesses, Jeff. I agree. One of them is just that you got a super dark pheasant.
It looks like a pheasant. Quacks like a pheasant.
The other possibility that exists, especially where you are, is a rough-legged hawk, which comes down from the far north in the wintertime. They come in two color phases, and one of them, actually a fairly common color phase, is literally all chocolate brown to nearly coal black. And they're often on the ground. That's they feed on mice. So it's possible you had a rough-legged hawk down there on the ground.
Well, I don't know if this has any bearing on it, but the bird squatted down like it was going to hide from me, and it was sitting in a wide-open white field in a black bird.
Hmm. Interesting.
It just didn't act like it had ever been in that environment.
Never saw it fly, huh?
No. It ran away, and it didn't act real intimidated, but...
Yeah, if it ran away, it's almost certainly a melanistic pheasant.
Yeah, because a hawk would have taken off.
Yeah, a hawk would have taken off. And virtually every species of bird has this rare, kind of like albino, but in reverse, has a rare color abnormality in which all of the feathers are completely pigmented with melanin, making it look basically black. So you probably got a black pheasant.
Sounds like a basis of a new TV series. We're talking about birds this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow, and we're talking about the Christmas, the bird count, and all kinds of stuff, answering your questions. Let's see if we can get another phone call or two. Ray from Lumberton, North Carolina. Hi, Ray.
Hello there.
Hi.
I'm Lumberton, North Carolina, but watching your event and you in Second Life.
You're in Second Life.
I'm in Second Life, and we all fly in Second Life, and you're in Second Life, actually.
Did you get a free T-shirt?
I did not get a free T-shirt. I'm sort of a newbie in Second Life. This is a very unusual experience. I'm surrounded by many birds. There's a Daffy Duck here and a pink pelican or a flamingo and a pelican, and there's a parrot on your mic.
There you go.
Second Life.
I know. We've got that there for the occasion. What's your question?
Well, my question is, what is the type of bird that is flying above us now?
In Second Life, you mean?
In Second Life.
I couldn't tell you, but I'll bet you there must be a birding society or some bird-watching organization in Second Life.
I'm sure.
My guess is, if there isn't, there is going to be after this.
And I'm sure there are people who will be keeping lists of birds that they've seen in Second Life, too.
And there should be a museum of all birds that have ever existed and their origin, you know, at least visually. That would be interesting. There's a lot to say. Anyway, I want to give a thank you to Geo Meek for bringing me here today.
You're welcome, and happy holiday to you.
Happy holidays.
And Second Life would be a great place to show pictures of birds and things. You could get them to fly. Yeah. As the avatars know, they're congregated around Science Friday Island in Second Life, and we have birds. People come in, a lot of bird costuming going on in Second Life. We have that little parrot on our little microphone there for birders today. What would you like to see? Anything that is surprising you about the bird count this year?
I mean, so far for this year?
Yeah.
I just took a quick look. I mean, at this point we've only got 92 counts completed online because obviously, I mean, the counts are still underway and will be conducted through January 5th, and then people have until toward the end of February to finish their data entry. But it seems like this year we're having a really good season for snowy owls. John was talking about the rough-legged hawks that's an Arctic raptor, and the snowy owl is sort of the one of the charismatic megafauna critters of the Arctic areas. And they apparently had a very good breeding season last summer, and also then later in the season, lemming populations, they tend to eat small mammals and things like lemmings, tended to apparently crashed a bit. And we've already had two or three counts this year that have more snowy owls than any count had last year. So it could be a very interesting year with that.
There's another pattern underway right now in the Northeast with a very unusual and beautiful bird called a white-winged crossbill. And I don't know, Jeff, whether you're starting to see counts that are finding crossbills on them yet.
I actually had four fly over me on the Northampton count on December 14th. So, yeah,
really amazing bird. This is one of the birds that's bill is literally it's crossed like a pair of scissors that don't meet at the end.
Wow.
Uses that funny bill to open up pine cones and eat the seeds out from inside the little plates covering the pine.
Wow.
Seeds.
Well, we have to take a break. We're going to come back and talk lots more about birding and then bring on a terrific new pop-up book called Birdscapes. And we'll listen to the birds and how well the sounds of the birds are captured in this terrific pop-up book. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.